in their place. We finished up Amos. And Hannah, you had asked a question a couple of weeks ago. Did anybody quote Amos in the New Testament? And lo and behold, I found one this morning while Ethan was teaching Sunday school. And yes, Ethan, I was paying attention. Oh, yeah, we're not up there. Okay. So, in Acts chapter 15, Ethan was talking about James this morning, James the brother, half-brother of the Lord. In Acts 15, it's James who settles the controversy that had been presented to the Jewish Christians about whether or not Gentiles had to be circumcised before they could be saved. And James steps up after hearing from Paul and Barnabas and some other people, and there was a big argument about whether they should support this idea. And he says, "Men and brothers, I want to say something to you." And he starts quoting a passage. I'm going to turn there real quick. And it's Amos. Yeah. He quotes Amos. Acts 15. What verse are we in there, Dan? 16. Yeah. Yep. Nope. Okay. I skipped by it. There. Yeah, there. Verse 15, "And with this the words of the prophets agree, just as it was written, 'After this I will return, and I will rebuild the tent of David that has fallen. I will rebuild its ruins, and I will restore it, that the remnant of mankind may seek the Lord, and all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord, who makes these things known from of old.'" So that is a passage from Amos. It's the last couple of verses of Amos. You know, Amos is a book about judgment, 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 and the last few verses give hope. Okay, God's going to bring judgment on Israel because of their sins, but he will restore Israel. And this is the passage that talks about the restoration. And do you see what's mentioned in there a couple of times? Right along with rebuilding the temple of, or the tent of David, he says that the remnant of mankind may seek the Lord and all the Gentiles who are called by my name. So James takes that as evidence to say God accepts the Gentiles on the basis of faith in Jesus Christ, not on the basis of any kind of work. And that settles the controversy. So there you go, Hannah. Amos played a very pivotal role in the first major theological controversy of the church.
Okay. Not
Joseph's fault. Yeah, that's right. Should I say Amos played a pivotal role in solving the first theological controversy in the church? Okay. So, do we need our Old Testament? Yeah, don't discard the Old Testament as out of date or irrelevant. Just because some of the regulations have been done away with in Christ, that Old Testament is important. We need to understand the prophets. We need to understand the law. We need to understand the histories. Those things are very, very important for the foundation of our faith. So, study your Old Testament, which is what we're doing here in our series, trying to help us understand the Old Testament prophets better. So let's review the order, the biblical order, of the Old Testament prophets. And as we have said, this is not the order they were written in, but it's the order we find them in the Bible. So that if you're looking for them, you know, if your pastor says, turn to Habakkuk chapter 3, you can say, oh, I know where that's at. Because it's Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. So there you go. If we're going to learn this by the end of this series, you're all going to know your prophets. Okay. All right. So tonight, we're starting into a fun prophet, maybe one of the most well-known ones other than Jonah, and that is Hosea. Anybody know the basic story of Hosea? Hosea? Ethan, I should have had you play Michael Card's song. Okay. What's that, Daniel? Yeah. If you've never heard of him, Michael Card is a Christian singer. He's been singing since, what, late 70s, I think. He's one of these guys that started off really kind of rocky and controversial, and as time went on, his theology deepened and his music got much richer. I think he actually has a seminary degree in theology, so the songs he writes are good, okay? And he writes a song about Hosea, and it's, "Hosea, you're a fool." And it's from the perspective of Hosea's wife, Gomer, because Hosea gets a very unique command. In order to understand that command, we've got to understand that the prophets were not just mouthpieces of God to deliver God's message. Very often, they were living illustrations of that message. What God wanted them to deliver was not always just words, but a living picture of something God wanted to communicate to his people. We'll see in a little while, there's a portion where Isaiah walks around naked for 3.5 years. Ezekiel, as we studied in Sunday school here pretty recently with Dan, Ezekiel was a living picture. One time God told him that instead of using the front door of his house, he was supposed to break a hole in the wall and walk out through there to illustrate that the people of Israel who were living in Jerusalem at the time were going to have to try to escape Jerusalem sneakily because the Babylonians were surrounding the city and destroying it. Ezekiel had to lay on one side for, what was it, like 190 days? Or maybe more than that, for almost a year, I think. He had to lay on one side and cook his food over a fire made with cow dung because God was using him to illustrate that that Jerusalem was going to be besieged for that amount of time. And so Hosea, the first part of his prophecy is going to be instructions on how to make his entire life a living illustration of a message that God wanted him to deliver. So we're going to review a little bit about the date of writing first and get some of the background here, and then we'll go into the text. Hosea gives us dates for his work. Oh, that's right, I turned to Acts. So here we go. Hosea says, "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel." I'm going to bring up our chart so that we can see a little bit of the timeline here. Daniel likes this chart. First, I have to rotate it. Hold on. Which way do we want to rotate it? Counterclockwise. Now, all right, can everybody see that? I'm joking. Okay, we'll zoom in here so that we can see a few things. This is a great resource. If you ever want to get a hold of this book that has these charts in it, it's, what's it called? A Chronology of the World by Frank Nolan Jones. Answers in Genesis sells it, I think, through Master Books. And it really is just, it's a great work. These charts are extremely valuable. Tell me when you can see these names and dates. A little bigger? One more? Okay. I can go that. Now, we can't see much of the dates and things, but this gives us a chart of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. So not right there, I think we can see both of them. We start off with Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. At the same time, Jeroboam the first is king of the northern kingdom. And as we go through time, you see the kings and how long they reigned. So if you've ever read through the books of Kings and Chronicles, and it says things like in the 18th year of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abijah, the son of Rehoboam, began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 3 years. So Dr. Jones took all that information and compiled this list for us in these charts. Really helpful. So we have in the southern kingdom, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram. Athaliah was the wicked queen that took over Jerusalem for 7 years. Joash, for whom we name our building fund here at the church. We call it our Joash Fund because Joash went on a major renovation of the temple. Amaziah, And there we get to a name on the northern kingdom, Jeroboam II. This is the Jeroboam that Hosea references, that his ministry was in Jeroboam's days. Jeroboam II, this is the same king that Amos lived during. That's a very badly constructed sentence, but gets the idea across. That's also the king during whose reign Amos lived. It gets complicated. So at any rate, Jeroboam II is the son of Joash. He's the king of the northern kingdom. And Uzziah, that's the first king of the southern kingdom that Amos, not Amos, who are we talking about? Hosea, that Hosea lists. So let me go back to the text there. Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Those are the kings of Judah. So I'm going to trace with you here that those kings. There's Uzziah on the bottom, and he reigns for 52 years, and then Jotham takes over, and after Jotham we have Ahaz, and after Ahaz we have Hezekiah. So it's a long span. If you do some math there, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. In the northern kingdom, he only mentions one king, and that's Jeroboam, the son of Joash. Well, Jeroboam overlaps Uzziah by quite a bit, probably 25 years there. They reign together with Uzziah in the southern kingdom and Jeroboam in the northern kingdom. When Jeroboam dies, his son Zechariah takes over, but there's some evidence that something was very wrong in the northern kingdom because it doesn't give us the standard formula that Zechariah reigned for, he was so old when he became king, and he reigned for 12 years. It actually just says Zechariah reigned for 6 months in the 38th year of Uzziah. And what that tells us is there was some huge instability in the northern kingdom. If you remember a little bit of our history, we've said Jeroboam II expanded the borders of northern Israel a long way. Uzziah in the southern kingdom expanded the borders of the southern kingdom a long way, so that between the two of them, they really possessed just about as much land as Solomon did in the glory days of the kingdom. After Jeroboam II died in the northern kingdom, God starts sending the Syrians in, and they start picking off land quickly. So if Zechariah only reigns for 6 months, that means it took him 11 and a half years to fully gain control of the kingdom. So what's going on up there? We don't really know. It's kind of a mystery, but it does tell us there was a lot of instability in the northern kingdom, which might be why Hosea does not mention any kings of the northern kingdom beyond Jeroboam. He gives us four generations of kings in the southern kingdom: Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And he only gives us one guy in the northern kingdom. Well, Jeroboam II, his reign ends right here. You see, he ruled for 41 years right here. And if I scroll up, we see that's about 784 BC is when Jeroboam died. Since Hosea mentions that his ministry occurred during the reign of Jeroboam, that means the beginning of Hosea's ministry must be before that date. And so we have a timeline for Hosea that begins, this actually is the label for Hosea here, I'll show you in a second, but it begins in about 785 BC. Now, he also mentions those four kings of Judah, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. And so Hezekiah takes the throne. So if you can keep track of this black line down here is the ministry of Hosea. We're guessing that it ends sometime around 720 BC. Hezekiah takes the throne in 726. So since he names Hezekiah as one of the kings under whom he ministered, Hosea must have continued into his reign a little bit. So we're at least to 726 BC. So from 785 to 726, we've got 60 years of ministry that Hosea covers. Now, we don't know how often he delivered one of his sermons or whether he was continually teaching, but we do know that he compiled his work for us and gave us the written portion of his ministry. But as we're going to make the case, his entire life became a living illustration of what God was doing in Israel over at least 60 years of ministry. That also tells us, if he had 60 years of ministry, then his ministry as a prophet must have begun when he was fairly young. There's another reason for that as well. So let's go back to the text. Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, and Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. So let's see here. I already told you that. Kings mentioned span about 60 years. Verse 2, here's the message. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go, take to yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord." There's the command, the beginning of his ministry. What's he supposed to do? Marry a prostitute. How many of you would have liked that command to come along? I want you to marry a prostitute. And I can imagine that Hosea is standing there saying, "You come again, Lord? I just want to make sure this is exactly what you said. Because what I'm hearing you say is, you want me to go marry a prostitute." And God reiterates, "Yes, that's what I want you to do." Now, this is really an interesting command. Go marry a wife of whoredom, and she'll bear children of whoredom. It means part of the result, the children she's going to bear are going to be the result of her adultery. She's going to be an example, and God tells us this there in verse 2. Why do I want you to do this? Go take for yourself this wife of whoredom. Have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So what is Gomer a picture of? The people of Judah, the people of Israel. They're unfaithful to God. This is going to be one of the first references. The prophets are going to use this quite a bit, that God compares idolatry with adultery. Ezekiel really picks up this picture in almost R-rated detail when you get into Ezekiel. But there's the command. I want you to go marry a prostitute. So here's part of the question that commentators have raised. Have we talked about commentators? Commentator, it's just your average potato. That's a commentator. It's not special taters or rare taters. This is commentators. I like when my jokes get laughs. That's just fun. Oh, ow. My wife says it's so rare that I get a laugh at my joke. Yeah. I had a great one for Ethan this morning, and he just stared at me. Did anyone else see the pens he handed out in Sunday school? Yeah, did you see what was on the box, what they were called? They're called stick pens. So I picked one up, and I put it on the wall, and I let go, and it fell. And I said, "Ethan, these aren't working." And he went, no, I don't want to know. I'm not doing this with you this morning. It's dad jokes. You have to. All right. Here's the question. Was she a prostitute before he married her? Yeah? Would God command somebody to marry a prostitute? Yes? Now, there is a prohibition against this in the law. Did I write down that verse? I didn't. Okay. I think it's Leviticus 21:17. Let's see if we can find that. I should have written it down. No, because that doesn't exist. Okay. It's probably not it. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
It exists?
Why didn't it find it? Oh.
Yeah.
What does it say?
It's about
Oh, okay.
What the priests, who were the priests were allowed to marry.
Oh, okay, okay. Oh, who the priests were allowed to marry?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, there you go. Okay, yeah, it's verse 14. Okay. Yeah, these are instructions. He shall not go out of the sanctuary, lest he profane the sanctuary of his God, for the consecration of the anointing oil of God is on him. I am the Lord. And he shall take a wife in her virginity, a widow, or a divorced woman, or a woman who has been defiled, or a prostitute. These he shall not marry. But he shall take as his wife a virgin of his own people, that he may not profane his offspring among his people. For I am the Lord who sanctifies him. Okay? Tim? Yes, it is. Okay, good. You guys pay attention to details well. I'm glad. Well, I put that point in there because it is the answer a lot of people go, well, she couldn't have been a prostitute when he married her because God commanded them not to marry prostitutes. Well, it is an important distinction to say God commanded the priests not to marry the prostitutes.
Okay. Makes it a better picture of Israel if she already is a prostitute when
okay. Possibly, but you know, was Israel unfaithful to the Lord when God took her?
No, because it was just
Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways we have to let God build his own picture there, right? So he tells us the picture is the land is unfaithful. So you're going to marry a woman who's unfaithful. Kathy? Mm-hmm. Ah, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because that actually is a line of reasoning to disbelieve what the scriptures tell us, because God never would have killed his only son. I mean, that's divine child abuse, right? Oh, you mean Abraham?
Yeah.
Yep. And people wrestle with that. So yeah, was. Was Abraham disobeying God's command not to murder by killing Isaac?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because here's part of the thing. God can command us to do whatever he wants. He's God. He has that right. It's a difficult position. Well, with Abraham, I think the thing gets cleared up pretty easily. Because he tells us not to murder. We do not have the right to take someone's life at a whim. But who does? God does. God has the right of life and death over everything that lives. So when he says take a life, it's not murder. You know, how did God command Joshua to go into the land and wipe out the Philistines, the Canaanites? I mean, this is tough for modern ears to hear because God's instructions to them are every man, woman, and child, and the animals in a lot of cases. And to us, it's like, wow, that sounds harsh. But God has the right of life and death over every living thing on this planet, including us. So when he says, take the life, it's not murder. Murder is taking a life when you don't have the right to do it. Murder is different from killing. And the command is not, you shall not kill. The command is, you shall not murder. Definitions are important. Well, so even if God had told the people of Israel, don't take a wife that's a prostitute, he could have abrogated that command and said, Hosea, I want you to do it. Okay. That's God's right. But as Tim pointed out, the command there isn't to the people at large, it's just to the priests. And we don't have any evidence that Hosea was a priest. We don't know what his profession was. Amos, we know he was a sheep herder and a sycamore fig tender. But we don't know what Hosea does. So, was she a prostitute when he married her? The language sure seems like she is. Go take a wife of whoredom. That particular way of phrasing things, a wife of whoredom, is very, very descriptive. It's like when Jesus calls the Pharisees sons of Belial. Right? Why does he call them sons of Belial? Were they literally children of Satan? No, spiritually they're children of Satan. You know, they were born to their parents just like we are. They're sons of Adam. But they reflect the character of their father. It's also why we are being transformed into sons of God and why we're called sons of God, because we are reflecting the character of our father. So when he calls her a wife of whoredom, it's describing a quality of her. She's a prostitute. And he says, have children of whoredom. Why? Because the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So, Hosea, here's your mission. Your life is going to be a living testimony of the unfaithfulness of Israel. Your marriage is going to be a constant, constant struggle for you. Now, studying the life of the prophets is a great study on faith and the commitment it takes to follow Christ. Because the things God commanded these men to do are not the normal kind of things that we like to think of. I mean, we like to think if God really loves me, then my life's going to be easy. I'm going to have a great marriage. I mean, after we preach sermons on 12 steps to have a great marriage, right? Is it always God's will to have a great marriage? Tough question, isn't it? Obviously, God doesn't want me to be the one causing the problem. I mean, he would command you not to be the one to cause the problem, right? But here, he's purposely telling Hosea, you're going to go marry a woman and she is going to cause you a great deal of problem. Yeah.
And how hard that would be to be willing to be that. You know, I get corrected for my sin. That's me.
Yeah.
I get a lesson from Scripture for my sin. That's me. But I have to suffer so that someone else can learn.
Yeah.
That'd be a tough place to be.
Yes. Yep. And that kind of willing submission to the will of God. You know, we celebrate Mary at Christmas time. When she says, you know, I'm the servant of the Lord, be it to me as the Lord commands. You know, God's call to Mary was not just to give birth to the Christ child. I mean, that's an amazing part of it. But God's call to Mary was to endure the public shame that would come from being with a child outside of marriage and everything that that meant in her society. Because guess what she's now going to be labeled as? Prostitute or something like it, right? And she had to put up with that, and I know that all went through Mary's mind in those few moments while she's considering, and then she says, yes, Lord, I'll do it. Yeah, great examples of commitment. Ezekiel, at one point in the middle of his ministry, God says to him, your wife's going to die tonight. Don't mourn. Don't show any signs that it's upsetting you. And this is going to be a picture to the people of Israel. And so it says, at evening, his wife died. And he was not allowed to go through the normal process of mourning. God told him, if you're going to cry, cry in secret. Don't let anybody see it. And so a little bit of that allowance for human weakness there, but this call to absolute commitment. And this is what God wants of us. He wants total commitment. What did Jesus tell us? No one that wants to follow me, you know, can, what was that? Anyone that puts his hand to the plow and looks back isn't worthy of me. Now, he that would come after me must deny himself and take up his cross. And that cross isn't just a picture of suffering. It's a picture of death. I have to die to everything I want if I want to follow the Lord, because he just might ask me to do something like this. And that's his prerogative. So, verse 3, he does it. He went and he took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. You know, it's interesting. This is one of the very few wives of the prophets whose names we know. And it's not a good one. This name does not come up ever on the top 10 most popular girls' names. You know, what amazes me is guess whose name does come up? Jezebel. People actually name their daughters Jezebel. What's that?
The world we live in.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, hopefully nobody's name here is really Gomer and you've been hiding it. What's that?
Delilah.
Yeah. Yeah. Delilah. So, Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, we really know nothing else about her than what's given to us right there. Hosea's name doesn't come up anywhere else. You know, he's the son of Beeri, and we don't get any family history on him either. So this is all we know about him. Well, he takes her, marries her, she conceives and bears him a son. Well, this is really interesting wording here, because whose son is it? It's Hosea's son. That's a good thing to know, isn't it? Because if she is that kind of a woman, there would have been question as to whose son it was. So there probably was some kind of a waiting period where it was, you know, she was watched very carefully to make sure she was not engaging in that immoral behavior, so that Hosea could validate the family line and make sure that this child that's going to be born is actually Hosea's. Well, the Lord said to him, that's to Hosea, call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So here's our first child between Gomer and Hosea. His name, his boy, his name is Jezreel. So, fun stuff about Jezreel. Let's go to our map and take a look, because we need to know where this is. The names are a little bit convoluted on there, but if you can see right here where the hand is moving, if you see this light green area that goes from the Jordan River Valley up and almost comes all the way up to the Mediterranean Sea, that's the Valley of Jezreel. It has another name that's very well known in the Bible, and its name is Megiddo. Because in Revelation, where do they gather the armies of the Antichrist? Armageddon, Megiddo, the Valley of Megiddo. So it's also called the Valley of Jezreel. And in the middle of the Valley of Jezreel, there is a city named Jezreel. So God tells Hosea, I want you to name your son Jezreel, the name of that city. Why? Whoop, my wrong one. Why? Because in just a little while, I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. This is going to take us a little bit of historical referencing as well. So I'm going to go back to our timeline so that we can see who he's talking about here. We are in the time period possibly of Jeroboam. Whoop, I'm sorry, I'm moving the wrong way. I'm trying to get us there. Jeroboam the second of the northern kingdom. As we said, Hosea probably begins his ministry somewhere right in here, 785 or really close to there, toward the end of Jeroboam the second's life. Jeroboam the second had a son whose name was Zechariah. Zechariah is the one that we said, the wording is, he ruled for 6 months in the 38th year of Uzziah. So he had a very rough time getting control of the kingdom. And then once he did get control of the kingdom, he was assassinated by a fellow named Shalom after reigning for only 6 months. Zechariah's death ends a dynasty in Israel. And guess whose dynasty it is? Well, if we trace back, Zechariah is the son of Jeroboam. Jeroboam is the son of Joash. Joash is the son of Jehoahaz. Don't you love these names? Jehoahaz is the son of Jehu. So, when God tells Hosea, name your son Jezreel, because in just a little while I'm going to punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. He's talking about this dynasty of Jehu. Jeroboam the second is the third generation from Jehu. It's going to be necessary for us to go back and get a little bit of historical context on Jehu. He's a really interesting character, so I want you to turn. Here, I'll summarize. If you want to write these down, you can. If you want to turn there, please feel free to do so. But Jezreel, as we said, is a valley in Israel. And so the child that's born to Hosea brings to remembrance the sins of Jehu that we just looked at, four generations before the end of that dynasty. Jehu was anointed as the king of the northern kingdom and I'm looking right here, by Elisha. Elisha the prophet sent his assistant to find Jehu, who was a general in the military of Israel, and take him into a private room, anoint him with oil, and tell him, you're going to be the king of Israel, and God wants you to avenge the house of Ahab. You remember Ahab. Elijah fought with Ahab his entire life because Ahab and his wife Jezebel brought Baal worship into Israel full force. And so God's condemnation on the house of Ahab was, I'm going to send Jehu to completely obliterate the house of Ahab. There's not going to be anybody left to carry on Ahab's family line. Well, in 1 Kings 9 is where we read about this. Jehu becomes king, and once he finds out he's been anointed king, he goes at it with great vim and vigor. He vehemently executed God's judgment upon Ahab's house until everybody was killed. He goes to the city of Jezreel and announces that Ahab's house is done ruling Israel. He kills Ahab's son, whom he finds riding a chariot, and shoots him with a bow. He also kills the king of Judah at the same time, because the king of Judah was partners in war with the king of Israel. And so he kills the king of Israel, which was Ahab's son. He kills the king of Judah, Ahaziah is his name. He also kills off a bunch of relatives of Ahaziah. Then he gets to the city of Jezreel, and guess who pokes her head out of a window to challenge him? Jezebel. She gets herself all painted up in royal attire to try to make an impression, and she sticks her head out the window and starts mocking Jehu. And she knows her husband's already dead. And Jehu's response is, it's almost comical, because he doesn't address her. He yells inside and says, anybody on my side? And a couple of servants poke their head out the window. And he says, throw her out the window. So they do. And they just chuck Jezebel out the window. She hits the ground in front of Jehu, dies, and he goes inside and eats supper. And when he comes back out, the dogs of the city have eaten her. There's nothing left but her hands. That was a fulfillment of a very specific... I mean, how many people die that way? Statistically speaking, I'd love to ask an insurance salesman, what are the odds that I will die by being eaten by dogs and only my hands are left? Okay. God prophesied that that's how Jezebel was going to meet her end, that her blood was going to be spilled in Jezreel and that the dogs of Jezreel would lick up her blood. And so he comes back out after dinner. All they can find are her hands and her feet. And so he buries those and says, well, she was a queen. Let's bury those, okay? So he buries them. He then sends to another Samaria and says, I know Ahab has 70 sons. 70, 7-0, not 17, 7-0 sons. So I want everybody to stop teasing me about having 7 children, okay? Ahab has 70. Jehu sends a message to the people of Samaria and says, put the best son of Ahab, put his armor on him, put him on a horse and send him out here. Let's have at it. And so they say, no. The governors of Samaria say, nah, we'd rather just surrender. And so they do. What do you want, Jehu? What's it going to take to save the city and we'll surrender to you? And he says, send me the heads of those 70 kids. Now, we don't know how old they are. Probably some of them full grown. But they do. They cut off all their heads and they send them in baskets to Jehu. So he effectively has the entire house of Ahab totally wiped out. Nobody to carry on the family line. Well, he also, as we said, killed Ahaziah, the king of Judah. That was not commanded by God. That is not something God told him to do. God did tell him to destroy the house of Ahab, and he did it faithfully. But then when he became king, he reinstituted the worship of the golden calves in the northern kingdom. And so God gave Jehu a promise in 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 30, and says, because you've done what I asked you to do in eliminating the house of Ahab, your sons to the fourth generation will sit on the throne of Israel. Fourth generation, okay? Now, what was God's message to Hosea? In just a little while, I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. It's time, prophetically. The alarm clock has sounded off. Jehu's dynasty is done. Go back to the timeline here, and what do we see? Jehu, now your sons to the fourth generation. Let's count them. Son of Jehu is Jehoahaz. That's number one. The son of Jehoahaz, Jehoash. That's number two. The son of Jehoash, that's Jeroboam the second. That's three. The son of Jeroboam the second, Zechariah. That's four. Zechariah was executed by Shalom, and no son of Jehu ever sat on the throne of Israel again. His dynasty was ended. God's fulfilling his prophetic word. And through Hosea's first son, Jezreel, he is announcing that he's going to bring judgment to the house of Jehu. Now, think about this naming here. Because the child is a reminder of Jehu's bloodshedding at Jezreel, he's also a reminder of the people of Israel following Jeroboam's idolatry. The first son's name is effectively, you people are wicked and judgment is coming. That's what Jezreel symbolizes to the northern kingdom. That's how Hosea's son is a message in himself to the people of Israel. So imagine that, moms. You're walking up, going to the market one day, and you're carrying your little baby, and everybody gathers, oh, he's such a beautiful little baby. What did you decide to name him? We named him, you people are wicked and judgment is coming. Come again? But that's what God was doing through Hosea. Your children are going to be a living testimony, a living message. So this first son's name is Jezreel. Okay, we don't have time to get into the second one, but we will. It's going to be lots of fun. Any questions about our first son of Hosea? Hey, guys. Feel bad for the prophet's kids? Yeah, there's a lot of submission they have to deal with too, don't they? From the very beginning to learn that I have to submit to God in something I had no choice over. I didn't choose my name.
I get that this is a big question. I guess yep. I'd have to get home, but I'm going to stay here. So the verse about not being punished for the sins of your father.
Yeah.
How is it that those four generations kind of get lucky because he did the one thing right, but then after that, they get punished for what he did wrong? Is there my misunderstanding here? Is that my fairness coming out?
There's several instances in the Bible where people rose up, committed a crime, like murdered somebody, murdered one of the kings. And the next king said, well, you know, I'm going to kill them, but I'm not going to kill their kids. It was standard practice in the ancient world that if Eldon rises up and assassinates the king and places someone else on the throne, well, what do? You get Eldon and you get his entire household. Why? Because the kids are going to follow Eldon, most likely, right? And so you don't leave any chance that Eldon or his family is going to do the same thing again. God commanded that not to happen. And several of the kings of Israel followed that command, and it's actually referenced that, a guy rose up, he executed the king, they put the king's son on the throne, and when he had the throne established in his hand, he executed the man that assassinated his father. But he didn't execute his children because that's what God commanded. And that again, I think, is going to go from our perspective. We are not allowed to punish the children for the father's crimes. But how many of us are totally innocent? None of us are. Now, there's probably some extent to which all of these kids participated in their father's crimes, because every king of Israel, it is said of him, he participated in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And so God removing them from ruling the kingdom was specifically for their crimes of They weren't innocent. Yeah. They were participating in the idolatry of the northern kingdom and using it to cement their power over the people. None of the kings of the northern kingdom ever tried to get rid of that idolatry. None of them. And so, the means God uses to accomplish his purpose, it's entirely possible that God would say, as a reward for what you did faithfully, to the fourth generation you're going to sit on the throne of Israel. And if those people had been faithful to the Lord, that when the time came, something else would have happened and they could have just stepped down peacefully. But because they participated in the sins of their father, the judgment came in a violent way. And they were killed as a judgment. Does that answer that question? Okay. Great. Any other questions? Hosea is a fun study. The first four chapters, are going to be about his family and the message that they deliver. And after that, he's going to turn into actually preaching sermons to the northern kingdom of Israel. So we will cover those things in the weeks to come. Okay? All right, let's go ahead and pray.